of the Living Economies Forum and a member of the Club of Rome. He holds an MBA and PhD degrees from Stanford Business School. He has 30 years' experience as a development professional in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, and he has served as a Harvard Business School professor, a captain in the U.S. Air Force, a Ford Foundation project specialist, and a regional advisor to the U.S. Agency for International Development. My name is Harrison Schultz. I'm a business intelligence analyst for a digital marketing company by day and an Occupy Wall Street general co-organizer by night. And I'm currently finishing my PhD in sociology at the New School for Social Research here in Manhattan. And I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Corton for a minute, let him introduce himself.
Yeah, I'm really excited to be with you folks. And I just wanted to throw in, I'm now 74 years old, which means that I've seen a lot of history, a lot of changes. And I truly feel that Occupy Wall Street is the most significant thing that's happened in my lifetime. We're just putting out a Yes Magazine book on Occupy Wall Street with a title, says it all. The title is This Changes Everything. And I'll not go further into that right now, why I think it does, but most particularly it opens up the kind of conversation we're going to be having today about the things that are not normally addressed in the corporate-controlled news media. And the deep changes we're all trying to bring about start with that conversation. So I am very much, I love what you're doing.
And we're happy to have you helping us occupy this conference call with us this evening. You're definitely part of the movement now. And I think the first thing we should start to talk about with you this evening, Dr. Corton, is we should try to clarify understanding of the relationship between Wall Street and the Federal Reserve, as well as our understanding of the relationship between the Federal Reserve, Wall Street, and Main Street. And we should also discuss some actual steps that the Fed could and should take to improve conditions on Main Street. And I want to start out with a quote I saw in your report from William Grider on page 29 of your report, which is available for the world on OccupyWallStreet.org right now. And William Grider wrote that, "The Federal Reserve is the black hole of our democracy. Its power depends crucially on people not knowing exactly what it does." Now, I'm personally not even entirely clear as to what the Fed is. I'm not sure if it's a privately held bank or if it's a federal institution, as its name would imply. And you also wrote on the very same page of your report that the Federal Reserve considers its primary mandate to be assuring that the solvency and profitability of Wall Street's megabanks. Now, could you begin by explaining what exactly the Fed is and to whom it's accountable, and what does it have to do with Wall Street?
Yeah, big questions. You know, in simple terms, it's the U.S. Central Bank. It was founded by Congress in 1913 to manage the money supply, which is an essential function in a modern society. If you're going to have a money system, you need a central bank to manage the size of the money supply and to influence where it goes. It also supervises and regulates the banking institutions. Now, you know, I don't want to get into the mechanisms by which the Fed manages the money supply, because that gets into a lot of technical detail, but it is an essential function, and that's the justification for it. Now, the real question then becomes, to whom is it accountable? Whose interest does it serve? And that's where it starts to get really fuzzy. You know, it is a creation of Congress. The Board of Governors is appointed by the President and approved by the Congress. So, and the term federal and Federal Reserve, it's all set up to make it look like a government agency. But if you really look at its internal structure, you see it's pretty much structured to be controlled and run by the big Wall Street banks. The government piece is kind of a cover. It's impossible to say with any definition that it's either public or private, but the primary loyalty is private. It's a very complicated board structure. In addition to the Board of Governors and the national structure, there's a set of regional reserve banks which are actually literally owned by the member banks, which are represented on the boards of these regional banks. They then, in turn, participate in appointing the national-level Federal Open Market Committee, which is actually the group that makes most of the decisions about how much money will be created and where will it flow. The regional banks have public members on their boards, but these are, in fact, appointed by the member banks or by the regional bank governors who have been appointed by the member banks. So if you get the picture there, you see how the governance structure kind of turns on itself and is self-governing.
Now, it seems that if there was a government structure within the Fed, there should be elections as opposed to appointments. Would that be correct?
Well, I think it's more complicated than that. I mean, what you want is you want strong, transparent public representation. And of course, the other piece here, the most critical piece, is that the Fed operates entirely in secret. Yeah, we rarely get any kind of view of what it's actually doing. One exception was the audit that was ordered by Congress following the 2008 collapse to get a public accounting of what the Fed actually did. And that audit, of course, revealed that in response to the crash, the Fed created $12.3 trillion in commitments, either putting new funds into the banks, as well as corporations and even foreign banks and corporations, bought up toxic assets and guaranteed other assets. So that was $12.3 trillion in exposure, which makes the $700 billion congressional bailout trivial by comparison, something of a sideshow.
Can I ask, where did that $12.3 trillion come from?
Simple accounting entries. Any of the folks here are familiar with This American Life on NPR, there's a marvelous episode some months ago that actually talked to some of the people in the room in the Fed where they go through and create this money. It is just simply accounting entries, which gets into what money is. And the fact that the Fed can create trillions of dollars out of nothing with accounting entries and essentially direct it wherever it sees fit gives you some idea of the enormous power it has. And to be able to do that all in secret with the primary governance being provided by the member banks, you get a picture of just how corrupt this system is.
So the Fed can basically create as much money as it wants and give it to whoever it wants without having to tell anybody.
Exactly. Except I assume it has to tell its own governors, who are essentially controlled by the member banks that the Fed is supposed to be regulating.
Interesting. Are there any appropriate questions on this topic from Twitter?
Yes, there are.
If you hold for one moment, Doctor, we'll get you another question from our audience here. Okay. We have question from Rhonda Amar. She's asking, have you seen the Zeitgeist documentary? Do you think it accurately presented the role of the Federal Reserve in our financial crisis? Thank you for your question, Rhonda.
Yeah, I have seen it. It was quite a while ago, and there are so many different stories about the Fed. I'd hesitate to comment on details of it. As I recall, the focus was that the Fed was essentially a creation of the banking industry, the big banks. The basic arrangements were worked out in a secret meeting on Jekyll Island and then sort of pushed quickly through the Congress. To my understanding, that is accurate.
Are there any other good sources we can go to in order to educate ourselves as to the Federal Reserve?
The classic is Bill Guider's book, The Secrets of the Temple.
Guider's Secrets of the Temple.
A lot of this is also covered in Ellen Brown's The Web of Debt. There are quite a number of other books on it. I mean, it depends on how much history you want, but the the history of the banking system in the United States and its power and role is pretty fascinating.
Interesting. Okay, so let's move on. I have a follow-up question to what we've been talking about. I wanted to ask, could Wall Street banks, could they have survived the financial crisis without intervention from the Federal Reserve?
No, certainly not. And of course, as I noted, the bailout from the Federal Reserve amounted in total somewhere in the order of $12.3 trillion compared to the $700 billion appropriated by Congress. The Fed is the ultimate guarantor, and of course, controlled by the same banks it's supposed to regulate. And this is a major part of the system that allows these banks to take huge, undue, inappropriate risks with the confidence that if things go bad and their bets go bad, the difference will be made up by the Fed or the public. So it's an amazing system where the it moves the wealth upward and pushes the risk downward. It's basically a total violation of basic market principles, and the folks who say that the government should have let the banking system collapse have basically got a point, except that would have dried up all the money in circulation. That really the government what it needed to do was step in and do a really thorough take over the banks and thoroughly reorganize the whole system, which we can talk about more later.
Okay. Do you have any questions from Twitter on the bailout or anything along those lines?
Asking about alternatives.
Yeah, we got a lot of questions about alternatives, which I think we should probably save towards the end of the conversation.
Yeah, I'm very eager to get into we need to fill it a little bit in the meantime.
Yes, because I'm still completely at a loss as to what this organization really is, except for a really big bank that really doesn't tell anyone what it's doing and gives people lots of money who don't need it. And apparently we have another question here. And I can't read Twitter feed. I'm sorry. I'm having a problem here.
Okay.
The documentary film Inside Job, an accurate representation of the buildup of Wall Street.
It certainly it's a movie that I enjoyed a lot, and it felt very accurate in terms of my understanding of Wall Street.
Great. So how about we move forward a little bit more? And I'd like to read a quote from your report, which I believe sums up the power dynamics between Wall Street, the Federal Reserve, and Main Street. And you wrote that Wall Street has become very clever at combining financial gains and creative accounting to inflate its own financial assets without the burden of producing anything of real value. It promotes public policies that the press wages to make money increasingly scarce for the people who produce real goods and services. It then lures the folks who do real work and are struggling to make ends meet into borrowing against their homes and credit cards, locking them into ever-growing debt with hidden fees and usurious interest rates. Wall Street institutions thus acquire an ever-growing portion of the money in circulation for their private accounts, thereby accumulating ever-growing claims on society's real goods and services and its material assets. In light of this quote, Dr. Gordon, could you please explain what it is you mean by phantom wealth as opposed to real wealth?
Yeah, this is a key to understanding the system. Now, I think back to my days in business school and the language that we use and that we're still indoctrinated in, terms like wealth, assets, capital, resources. When someone uses those terms, you have no idea whether they're speaking about money or whether they're speaking about real things, and that's the difference between phantom wealth and real wealth. By phantom wealth, I refer to money, which is in fact nothing but a number. And in our current system, most money is nothing but a number on a computer hard drive. you know, which is why, in a sense, the government had to step in to bail out Wall Street, because if the banks had collapsed and those computers shut down, most all the money in the world would have disappeared. And, you know, just try to imagine that happening, what that would do in terms of the economy. Now, real wealth consists of things of real value. So, you know, the basics, land, labor, technology, those are forms of real wealth. The most valuable forms of real wealth are the ones that are beyond price, which would be a healthy, happy child, peace, a strong, vibrant community, healthy, natural environment. These are all essential forms of real wealth, and if we think about a real economy, we would be thinking about how we as people organize the real resources of society to meet real needs of real people, and of course doing that in a way that maintains the health of the of Earth's natural systems on which we ultimately depend. The money system is, you know, properly understood. Money is a very useful modern institution for engaging in market transactions, a medium of exchange. But we've created a system that's, you know, really enchanted us. It's a kind of enchantment or a hypnosis. That leads us to confuse money, which is nothing but a number, it's all manipulated by accounting transactions, to think of that as real wealth. And then we think of, well, people who are making money are creating wealth, so that is a good thing. But if we break out of that and we recognize what we've got is a banking system, which is the system through which those numbers are created and allocated, that becomes an incredible system of power. Now, one of the things I don't think you'll ever hear in an economics course, I certainly didn't hear it when I was a student, and I doubt they still mention it, is that in a modern society where most everything we do depends on money, our access to food, to shelter, to heat, to transportation, to recreation, or whatever, depends on our access to money, and that gives enormous power then to the people who are in a position to create those numbers and decide who gets them. And that is what Wall Street is about. Now, a proper money system would be allocating that money to Main Street, to real businesses that are engaged in meeting needs of local people in their communities, producing real goods and services, financing the buying of homes by real home buyers and so forth. That's what a money system should be doing, and we once had such a system, which we can talk about a bit, but based on local Main Street financial institutions. But what's happened through a process of deregulation is a concentration of the banking control of banks and financial institutions that's now shifted the power of money creation and allocation from communities to these Wall Street institutions that in fact have no interest in creating jobs or in producing real goods and services. And if you read the business press, it's just amazing that the ideal of Wall Street banks and corporations is to make as much money as possible without the inconvenience of producing anything of real value. So they have gotten into all the stuff they call financial innovation, which is very clever at essentially creating money out of nothing, which then increases the claims of the Wall Street players over the real wealth of the rest of the country, but without producing anything of value in return. And that's the foundation of so much of the dysfunction that's going on. We used to be somewhat critical of the idea of these corporations operating solely for the benefit of their owners or their shareholders. And that was indeed a problem, but those were actually the good old days compared to now, because if you really look at what happened in the Wall Street collapse, what the managers of the system were really doing was not managing it even for the benefit of their shareholders, many of whom are, you know, pensioners and so forth, but solely to maximize their own bonuses. So it was all about maximizing transactions that became the foundation of generating their commissions and bonuses without regard to the consequences for anyone, including even their own shareholders.
You've been mentioning an older system, you know, back during the 40s, 50s, 60s, and you write about it a lot in your report, and I wanted to bring that up. Before we go there, I wanted to ask you, do you think that the money system, the power to create and distribute money, does that have an I imagine it does, but what kind of effect does that have on our political system? Does the ability to control the distribution and creation of money, does that enable these individuals to hold some sort of power over our political systems as well?
Well, I suspect everybody on the call has noticed that themselves. I probably don't really need to comment on it. But it is, you know, it is part of understanding the money system as a system of power, that who controls our access to money, not only controls our access to the real resources, the real wealth of society and the planet, but they also obviously control the political system because, ultimately the way our electoral system operates, money is crucial to any politician who wants to get elected, and so they have to pay attention to the people who have money. Now, from the Wall Street standpoint, it's not just their control over the money; it is also then their control over so much of the media, the corporate media. So they're not only controlling access to the money that politicians need for campaigning, but also to controlling the media messages that are being put out to the public, by which the public understands, the capabilities, positions, merits, and so forth of those people running for office. So,
So our money system has a big impact on our media system as well.
Yeah, because of the enormous concentration of media and control by a very few corporations. When I was growing up, we not only had this local financial system, but there was also, the media operated by journalistic standards. Even most corporate media organizations, there was a firewall between the business side and the editorial side, and journalists took great pride in their editorial independence to actually communicate truth. Now, you can argue that there was a lot of monkey business there too, but compared to what we have now, it operated with an extraordinary integrity.
Right.
Whereas now it's quite self-consciously operated as a marketing machine and a propaganda machine to serve corporate interests.
Okay, we've been talking a bit about money systems, and I'd like to ask, why do you refer to our money system as a failed system? And I'd also like to officially throw out the question that you also say that in the mid-20th century, we had a system that worked rather well. And what was different about that system, and what are the lessons from that system for today?
Yeah, I call it a failed system. Well, it's interesting. You can say at one level it's doing exactly what Wall Street designed it to do, which is to... Mm-hmm. Concentrate wealth in its own hands. But from the society standpoint, it is a deeply failed system that to put it in Occupy Wall Street terms, is primarily benefiting the 1% of the population at the expense of the 99%. It's not only, of course, failed in terms of equity. It is destroying families. It is destroying communities because of the pressures of the unemployment that it creates. It is squandering the resources of the planet, working in direct opposition to the living systems of the biosphere, and it's corrupting our political system. So, from the standpoint of society, it is a colossal failure. It is destroying all the foundations of life and civilized society. which is why I argue in my books that, well, it's actually why I wrote Agenda for a New Economy very quickly, to get out the point that this is not a broken system that needs to be repaired and fixed and restored to its previous state. Because what it was, what the system was doing in its previous state was enormously destructive. That from a societal standpoint is a failed system, and our goal needs to be to replace it with a system that actually serves society.
So is it a matter of fixing our system, or is it a matter of creating new goals?
Well, it starts with new goals and recognizing that the key variable is power. And this is where it's so powerful and so appropriate that Occupy Wall Street is pointing the finger to Wall Street as the problem, because it is very much the source of the problem. Now, the solution, the alternative economy, the similar metaphor of Main Street. Which is basically a vision of a much more democratic society. It aligns back with our concept of America as a middle class nation.
Right.
Of course, our former middle class tended to exclude people of color, and there are a lot of defects that we need to address. But the basic idea of a society in which wealth is shared equitably across all the elements of the society is a foundation of what most of us grew up thinking America was about. And so the idea of a Main Street economy, which is owned and operated by a middle class to meet their own needs, is an essential foundation of democracy. I mean, it's part of the idea that they're really, the idea of political democracy without without economic democracy is an illusion. And I'm not talking here about socialism. I'm talking about real markets and real democracy. Another piece of this is recognizing that a real market economy, as envisioned going back to Adam Smith, basically looks a lot more like a local farmer's market, where farmers come in and sell their goods directly to consumers, than it does a global economy that is centrally planned and managed by Goldman Sachs, Monsanto, and Walmart. So the key frame around the alternative, the solution, is essentially actions to rebuild the middle class and to rebuild our local economies, our Main Street economies, and our local financial institutions. So, the whole focus on move your money from Wall Street banks to your local credit union or a true local bank is a very key part of that process, and a very, very important initiative that, of course, is gaining enormous momentum around the country. But we also need to be, the concentration of power came through a systematic effort by Wall Street to roll back progressive taxation, to lower taxes on the rich, and to take away the regulatory framework that was necessary not only to hold the banking system accountable to community interests, but also to maintain its integrity. So it's focused on funding real investment rather than playing financial games. So a lot of what we need to do is Wall Street rewrote the rules to shift the power away from Main Street, and by implication, away from productive investment, to shift that power to Wall Street institutions that had no connection to community, and that have no interest in productive investment, or incidentally in job creation. I mean, the way you make a lot of money as a corporate CEO is not by creating new jobs, but rather by announcing that you've just laid off 10,000 people, or you're going to move 20,000 jobs overseas to a low wage market.
I see. We have a question over Twitter from Lisa Rubenstein, and she's asking, when did the new system start? When did we see this transition from our our system in the mid-20th century, which is a bit more local to what we have now, which I'm assuming is a bit more global.
Yeah, the Wall Street interest started mobilizing in early 1970. I think it was about 1972 or 73. A lot of people trace it to a memo by Lewis Powell to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, you know, outlining a program for Wall Street corporate interests to regain control of the economy and the political system. Now, it really, you know, that started the build-up, and some of the banking deregulation started actually under the Carter administration. And
the Democratic administration.
Pardon?
Administration of Democrats.
The administration of Democrats, and then it really picked up traction under Reagan, the administration of Republicans. And it, you know, it followed through pretty much seamlessly from there. Including with the Clinton administration, which was responsible for rolling back Glass-Steagall, and which of course was pushing hard on the free trade agreements, which are also part of the corporate agenda to circumvent democracy and free themselves from any public accountability or national interest.
Well, it seems like our political parties are certainly able to reach across the aisle and come together when it comes to redistributing the wealth of this nation.
Would you
agree with that?
They're very good at it, and it really makes you wonder about a system that creates the impression of being deeply divided, but when push comes to shove, both parties end up working pretty wholeheartedly for the same interests.
We're starting to get a lot of good questions over Twitter with regards to alternatives to the Federal Reserve. So I think we should start to steer the conversation that way. And I'd like to start with another quote from your report. And you wrote, "If only 3 to 4 trillion of the 12 trillion in keystroke money created by the Federal Reserve following the 2008 crisis had been directed to building an energy-efficient green fiscal infrastructure, we would now have a booming national economy and be on our way to securing the future of America's children." So what should the Federal Reserve do in order to end the crisis? And how would a Federal Recovery and Reconstruction Bank, as proposed by William Grider and yourself, distribute the money supply differently than our current Federal Reserve?
Yeah, interesting. What this brings us to is that there are kind of two fundamental issues. One was avoiding a bailout to avoid a complete collapse of the whole financial system. The other is the issue of financial stimulus to stimulate the economy to create jobs. Now, there's a whole other set of issues about whether or not simply stimulating economic growth actually creates jobs. But the more immediate issue is that when the Federal Reserve pumps money into the system under the guise of stimulating the economy, they put that money into these same Wall Street banks through a variety of mechanisms that, in fact, are not engaged in job creation, that are more engaged in job destruction. And so it doesn't, you know, it doesn't produce any beneficial outcomes. It's sort of duh, yeah. Now, the proposal that I picked up from William Grider, for whom I have enormous respect as, the leading authority on the Federal Reserve, at least the critical authority, Grider has recommended the creation of essentially a federal reconstruction bank, which other people have been actually suggesting. But the thing that's different about his proposal is to set up a system by which the Federal Reserve, if it is creating new money to stimulate the economy, instead of putting it into the Wall Street banks, would put that money into a Federal Recovery Reconstruction Bank, which would have a list of projects, infrastructure projects, green infrastructure projects that have been approved by Congress, that it would then use this money to fund in what I believe the technical term is non-recourse loans. Essentially, since this money is created directly by the Fed, it need not, there's no interest on it, and it need not be repaid. But then, it, you know, then those construction projects would put the money directly to work, hiring people to do the to do this infrastructure construction. That money, ideally, if we move in the direction of a decentralized local banking system, would move into local banks, which would then be recirculating that money as loans to other local businesses and to local homeowners. So the basic idea here is, yeah, you need a central bank. There are times if the economy is failing and people are not being put to work to meet critical needs, then you can create the money to do that. But that money needs to go directly into Main Street, into hiring people, so that it then comes into the to the larger system at the bottom, where people are connected to their community and to community needs. They care about their families, they care about their neighbors, and they have a real interest in a healthy natural environment. So it's a fundamental flipping the system on its head. And you know, again, part of what's so important about Occupy Wall Street is that it allows us to open up this conversation to think about the systems and how the systems shape how our society functions and bear responsibility for all the dysfunctions we're experiencing, because we've all got to become, you know, not real experts, but have a recognition of how institutional systems shape the behavior and function of the society.
If I could try to backtrack just for a moment and try to get a better sense of what it is you mean with the phrase flipping the system on its head, because I think that's really important. I did a little stint at the Bank of America at all places. I was working as an admin assistant, and it was a really unpleasant experience. I totally hated it, and I really didn't like any of the people I was working for, and I thought that they were all really good. I thought they'd mastered the art of running around making it look like they were doing a lot of work, when in actuality I think they were just trying to avoid spending time with families that they didn't really care that much for. So it's really interesting to read your report and hear you essentially argue that, you know, these bankers are essentially just stealing, well, not stealing money, but appropriating material resources for themselves and not creating any real wealth back. And it seems like it needs to be asked, why is it, how have Americans gotten to the point where they're willing to reward people with so much for not actually doing anything? I mean, I thought this country was founded on hard work and in industry and perseverance, and I mean, this does, our money system does seem like a complete reversal of everything we are supposed to stand for. Would you say that's true?
I would. And you know, it's very interesting, the charges that come from the Wall Street establishment, that the the Occupy folks are just lazy and don't want to work, and all that nonsense.
Seems fairly hypocritical.
Well, yeah, but it's also, I mean, to begin with, my sense is it is totally untrue that most of the folks, particularly the leaders of that movement, are folks that love to work in constructive work. But the other is
that Priscilla and I are kind of nodding our head, doing spirit fingers here, because we're both running on very little sleep.
The other side of it is, if there is a deterioration of the morals in the society, it does not start with the people at the bottom. It starts with the people at the top who have set this example of a system that provides massive rewards for people who are either doing nothing or engaged in activity exclusively that either is criminal or should be criminal.
So can I quote you as having said that the 1% in this country is responsible for the deterioration of our national moral standards?
Absolutely.
Cool.
Absolutely.
Let's
now,
go to Twitter.
It is the system, and it's very important to keep a distinction between the system and the people who work in it. Now, some of those folks, there is a disproportionate percentage of people at the top of the system that are certifiable psychopaths. They are, you know, fundamentally, morally and psychologically dysfunctional. But most of them are, you know, are good, ordinary, decent people, but they are conditioned by an institutional system that rewards pathological behavior. And it's also part of our human psyche. We are, you know, our brain is wired to work within a cultural framework, a set of shared beliefs. So you get a set of shared beliefs, a perverse value system in these Wall Street institutions, and people tend to buy into it because that's what the system tells them. That's the social norm. On the other hand, it generally does not make them happy, as you experienced. You know, most of those folks are absolutely miserable.
I did notice that.
And it's, you know, it's fascinating what we pick up through Yes Magazine that, you know, one consequence of the unemployment is that a lot of people who have been forced into unemployment and been forced to rely more on family and to start their home gardens and get involved in community activities, finding their true sources of happiness and sense of fulfillment. And I would guess that part of your experience in Occupy Wall Street, I mean, as I understand it, it's, you know, it's a huge community building exercise, people coming together and figuring out how to meet their needs in common and supporting one another. And, you know, it's a huge high.
Definitely.
Of a sort that we rarely get in our modern society. So it's, you know, part of what the demonstrations are about is rediscovering what it is that makes us human and what are the true sources of our happiness.
Twinkle. I'd love to keep this conversation going about the pathological behaviors of individuals that work on Wall Street, but we got some good questions coming in over Twitter. Kind of an interesting question I'd like to pitch to you. ODD Wayne asks, do you believe in cyclical recessions, irresponsible activities, or deliberate efforts to literally subdue the masses?
Well, certainly as a matter of fact, the economy tends to work in cycles. I think that is a function of the of essentially the Wall Street structure and the dynamics of the money system, which tends to go toward massive speculation, then crashes, and then we put in some rules and get things in order, and then you remove the rules and revive the speculation. If we do what I believe is necessary to restructure our economies, starting not with how do you make the most money, structure the economy to make the most money, but how do you structure the economy to best support life, living systems, living people, living families, living communities? There is no necessary reason to have that cyclical economy dynamic.
I see. I always thought that was natural as well. I thought that was just how economics worked.
Economics is pretty much, as a science, it's very interesting. It's really built around money and how money flows and pricing. And yet the extraordinary thing is that most economists don't really understand money.
Hmm. We're going to start jumping around a little bit more here because I'm out of most of my main questions for you. But we have another question from Lisa Rubenstein over Twitter. And she's asking, how do we obtain transparency to reveal the truth to others? How do we obtain transparency with regard to the Fed, this massive black hole within our democracy?
Well, okay, the two very different elements here. Part of the proposal for transforming the money system, and you referred to my report, which is called How to Liberate America from Wall Street Rule, and I believe you indicated it's on your website.
Yes, please go to OccupyWallStreet.org and download Dr. Corton's report right now.
So part of the change as it relates specifically to the Fed is, we need to restructure the money system to operate essentially as a totally transparent public utility. So the first point with the Federal Reserve is to remove all the secrecy. If what the Fed does cannot be done in public, then there's probably something wrong with it. It should be totally transparent. It should be subject to periodic public audit, and all its records should basically be subject to public review. Now, the other piece, which I think is what the caller is or the tweeter is referring to, is we have, as a society, been living in a cultural trance that clouds our ability to see what our economic options really are, to understand what the economic system, and particularly the money system, is actually doing. And the key step to change is to wake up from that trance. Now, in a way, that's not so esoteric. It's the critical element is to engage the conversation, just as we're doing right here, about the reality of that system. Now, we've seen the Wall Street interests have been very clever in their campaign and their takeover in controlling the national story. The story about what is wealth, how is it created, what is our human nature, all of these fundamental questions, they answer with a story that leads to conclusions that we need to give more power to Wall Street. We need to cut taxes on the rich. We need to get rid of the rules so that the wealthy job creators can do their thing. Now, that's all, it's contrary to reality. Every element of the story is falsified from the truth. So the starting point for deep change is simply opening the conversation in which we speak share the truth with each other, and expand the circle of the conversation. And that, that is the enormous power of Occupy Wall Street. You have already fundamentally changed the national conversation, and that is a huge victory.
I would completely agree with that, and I think we've specifically changed it. We've moved it away from, essentially Republican and conservative agendas of balanced budgets towards discussions of wealth inequality, and I think that's really important. I think that is a huge victory, but I feel like there's been so many lies over the past few decades, if not centuries, that, this one talk we're doing is not, it's not going to cut through all of those lies. We need to have these talks on a regular basis. We need more people on these talks, because I feel like the conversation needs to get deeper and broader.
We need people organizing the conversations in their communities. I mean, one of the things I've found from my work is that my major contribution is that I have the freedom to speak the truth as I understand it. And we're all so conditioned to the lies. It's always amazing to me, every time I reach a breakthrough in my thinking, how obvious the truth is, but how hard it is to get to because we never hear it spoken. But as soon as a person hears it spoken, most people can recognize it immediately, and you really don't have to keep repeating it. Part of the key is opening up the space so that we can have these kinds of conversations, in our community organizations, in our churches, in our homes, and that's a critical piece of shifting the cultural frame, which then ultimately leads to fundamentally redefining the debate about what our economic choices are. And this,
you
of course, another piece.
Sorry.
We've been. I assume you guys are still being educated as you grow up to the idea that we really only have two economic choices. One is the communist system, which has failed, and the other is the capitalist system we have.
Which has also failed,
and it's a basic lie in itself. These are not our only two choices, because both of those, as we know them, result in a massive concentration of illegitimate and unaccountable power. Which is why both of them fail. And the answer is to, it is a localized economy, which is based on local control, which is consistent with real democracy and with real markets, and which, not incidentally, actually moves in a direction of that aligns very much with concerns of a lot of libertarians who are really concerned about local control and about individual responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
But the key is, can we bring the competing frames together in a way that helps us see that the real answer is a localization of power within a framework in which we all respect the individual and the individual rights and the need for individual responsibility, but also recognize that for society to work, we all have an obligation, a responsibility to the community and for the well-being of the community. And it's kind of like the way I see living systems, including, if you think about our own bodies, the cells in our body, each one is an individual living entity, but its health and function depends on the function of the entire organism. And if you understand how the cells operate, it's amazing how they maintain the balance between their individual health and their contribution to the health of the whole.
I think we have just about enough time left for two more questions, and mm-hmm. one of which I think is kind of the most important question, one we've been kind of saving for the end here. Is it realistic to break the Fed up? Is it realistic to abolish the Fed? Based on the conversation we've been having, it doesn't sound like you would agree with that, seeing as how you're arguing that we do need some sort of central banking oversight. But is this a realistic proposal? Because it's one we hear often.
Yeah. If you're going to have a national money system, you need a central bank. But the key is that it should be totally transparent. And it should be publicly accountable. That gets into a lot of technical issues, because there is a need for a degree of independence, but there is also an essential need for accountability, and it definitely should not be run by the bankers who it should be overseeing. So that's part of the whole idea of the whole. It comes back to the fact that if you're going to have a money system, you've got to have an institution that is responsible for managing the supply, the amount of money in circulation, and with some oversight on where that money flows.
I see. I think the last question I have to ask to sort of wrap up here. We're not just here to talk about the Fed. This has been a great conversation, but I think we need to do something about the Fed. I think we need to take action, and we are occupiers. We like occupying things. Do you think it would be useful to get off this call, go down to our local Federal Reserves all across this country, and continue this conversation there sometime? Would you like to see mass rallies at every single Federal Reserve all at the same time, all across this country?
Absolutely. I mean, it's part of pointing the finger where the problem resides. Now, that said, the Fed is not going to reform itself from within. So we're not demanding that the Fed do something different, but we're letting the politicians know that we recognize that the Federal Reserve is a deeply, as it is currently structured, a deeply destructive institution. And it's fascinating that this also is potentially a powerful bipartisan issue. The difference is, the fact that this audit that Congress demanded was supported by almost 100% of both the Senate and the House of Representatives, a pretty rare thing, because it was a very very important action. Now there's a lot of difference on what you do after you take control of the Fed, and one side wants to shut it down and essentially privatize the management of the money system based on a gold standard, which to me would be absolutely insane. Is based on a total misunderstanding both of of the nature of the money system and of the values it should be serving.
I was told that the gold standard system is a scheme that's almost as old as money itself.
Yeah, it is. It's essentially going back to the original the original thing where money was issued by goldsmiths that held gold in their vaults, and that was the beginning of the corruption of money, because they ultimately, operating without rules, issued more gold certificates by far than what they had in their vaults. So, you know, it works okay until people decide they want to come and redeem and get real gold, and then you get the typical kind of financial collapse. So yeah, the size of the money supply should not be determined by how fast we can mine gold. It should be based on our assessment of what the scale of the economy and economic activity is, and how do we get the best balance between underutilized resources and unmet needs. And that has nothing to do with gold or any other particular commodity.
Certainly doesn't seem like it. Well, Dr. Corden, thank you very much for taking time to speak to Occupy Wall Street and for educating us on the Federal Reserve. I've definitely learned a lot from this talk. I hope all the listeners have as well. And I hope everyone in this movement is now inspired to go out and occupy the Fed. I'd like to get in touch with everyone on this call and start coordinating a way to go do that. So thank you very much for your time this evening, Dr. Corden.
Thank you. It's been my privilege.
Well, we'll have you on again sometime, I'm sure.
Whenever you want.
Thanks a lot. Have a good evening, sir.
Thank you.
Good night to our listeners as well.
You are now presenting live. You can begin recording this presentation at any time by pressing 3. To stop recording, press 4.